Welcome to Effective Relationships. Today's topic, DISC introduction. Here we go.
Well, folks, if you've been listening to our podcast for any length of time at all, you know that we are huge fans of something called the DISC profile. That's D-I-S-C. And the reason is simple. We found that DISC is the most effective tool we found for understanding behavioral tendencies of yourself and the people you interact with each day. And if you understand those, you can be more effective. You know, the problem, Mark, and the reason we haven't talked about it so far, really, here on Career Tools, is that our regular casts are actionable. And this cast isn't terribly actionable, but important nonetheless. So we've never given that overview of DISC to facilitate that broad understanding of the system.
Yeah, and we do it all the time at the conference, right? When we do an effective communications conference, when we teach people how to pay attention to other people's behaviors and then modify their own communication styles to be more effective with somebody, you know, it's by definition, we have to do it at the conference. So we take an hour, hour and a half at the conference and really lay it out in detail so people can understand the underpinnings of the tool.
Yeah, and it would help probably listeners to our podcast if every time we made reference to DISC, they knew what we were talking about.
Exactly, right.
Instead of their spending cycles trying, what the heck are they talking about now?
Yeah. So if your boss has given you a DISC profile to take and you've never heard of DISC before, or you think DISC sounds good based on what we've told you, or maybe you've gotten DISC from your company, or maybe even from another trainer or consultant, and you really don't get it or don't like it or whatever, this cast is for you. We're going to cover four things. We're going to tell you what DISC is, just the basics. Okay. Then we're going to tell you how you read your profile, what those numbers mean, what the graphs mean, so on. Then we're going to talk about what you can do with this information. And then we'll give you some examples, some vignettes of the four styles. Now, this is really basic stuff for DISC. Manager Tools and Career Tools focus on DISC is really taking it to the next level. What we're going to talk about today is understanding DISC and you. So you can get a sense of, you know, when you read your profile, it'll make more sense. Although the materials that Inscape provides are very good that you get from us.
But that's not what the power of DISC is, right? That's not where the real power. The real power is not understanding yourself, it's changing your behavior.
Yeah, in fact, I say this at conferences all the time, Mike, that people love DISC because they get this incredible aha that they can answer 28 questions. And at the end, they read this profile themselves and go, oh my gosh, that is accurate, creepily, eerily, unbelievably.
Or they don't think it's accurate and they have their spouse look at it and the spouse goes, oh yeah, that's you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're certain that no tool could do it. And then they go, uh-oh. Or they don't believe it and then their coworker looks at them and goes, oh no, that's you. Trust me, dude, that's you. And the issue is that, you know, it's great. That aha about ourselves is great, but that's really not the value of DISC, knowing yourself. Although there is some value in knowing yourself and being able to see what situations are naturally leaning to, you know, help you and other situations, which are harder for some of us. But the real value is understanding other people. And that's what DISC gives us the basics for. And that's what our conference is about, is understanding what other people's tendencies are and then be able to use that tendency to be more effective when you communicate with them.
Exactly. So, okay. So what is DISC?
Start with DISC. This is going to sound really formal to say it's a four quadrant behavioral model. But just a little bit of background. There are all kinds of personality profiles. DISC is not a personality test. It's a behavioral test. It purports to show, and in 25 years of using it, I've never had it not show 10, 20,000 users over those years. I've never had it not show what somebody's behavioral tendencies are, all things being equal. Most behavioral profiles, most personality profiles, most tests, what we call psychometric tests, meaning things that measure how your psychoness or your intellectual or your emotional tendencies, tend to have a four quadrant model. And if you think of a standard square with a vertical line and a horizontal line dividing it, you end up with it, what we call a 2x2 matrix. It looks like four squares shoved together to make one larger square. And the reason that's important is because if you ask a person any two questions that are essentially bifurcated, in other words, they have two possible answers, often they're yes and no when we use it for business analysis regarding, you know, a yes or no question. And one of the questions is on the vertical axis and one is on the horizontal axis, you get four quadrants. There's four possible answers. There's yes, yes, no, no, yes, no, and no, yes. The same thing, that same basic intellectual or measuring idea is in place with most of the behavioral instruments or psychological or personality instruments that you'll see. They ask two questions with two different answers. It gives you four possibilities. And then there's a series of subtleties that go into creating perhaps even more subtle interpretations of the data. The important thing to note about what I just said, that's as scientific as I get, but the whole point of DISC is to find out about a person based on their answers to a series of questions about words that describe their behaviors and their intent and so on, is understanding their tendencies. Every single person in the world tends to, over time, adopt certain tendencies of behavior. One way to think about this is to think of the human being is born. They have some genetic tendencies. Okay. There are all kinds of studies that show that kids of certain type of parents tend to be more like those types of parents, whatever that tendency might be. Then over time, based on their environment, they develop what we might call a personality on top of that. Some people will tell you by the time a human being is 10 years old or 12 years old, they're going to have their personality. Other people say, no, it's 14 or 15. I generally describe it as the 10 to 12 rule, but it doesn't matter much because we're not working with kids here. And essentially what happens is the combination of your nature, your genetic code, your makeup, and your nurture, what happens as a person growing up, causes you to lean towards certain tendencies in your behaviors. Some people are outgoing, some people are not. Some people tend to think about things, some people tend to feel about things. There are all kinds of subtleties. And the idea here is that DISC says the behavioral characteristics of somebody, how they behave, not what they're thinking, not what they're feeling, but how they behave, the words they say, the way they say them, their facial expressions, their body language, and so on, if you pay attention to it, can help you understand what's important to them, how they view the world, and how they are likely to react to us. There are people in the world, I'm sure you've met them, that you just naturally click with. There's a good chance that those people whom you're naturally clicking with have the same style as you or a very similar one. People who you don't seem to ever click with, you can't seem to get along with, you're always not really at cross purposes, but you don't just naturally get along with, those people are probably a very different style than you. In fact, if you think of a 2x2 matrix, if you're in the top right, they're in the bottom left. Or if you're in the top left, they're in the bottom right. And it's important to note that DISC tells us, based on these questions, with the unerring accuracy in our experience, it tells us how we and other people, of course, behave when we're not thinking about behaving, which generally tends to be true. We tend to put our intellectual prowess, we focus ourselves in a conversation or in an interaction with someone, we focus it on the topic at hand, not how we're interacting. Okay. And so what happens is we develop these patterns. And if you have either a way of understanding other people's patterns by inferring it, which we teach at the conference, or their DISC profile, you can know, gosh, if Mark gets a question about what kind of ideas might he have, Mark will have 50. He doesn't really care whether they're good or not. Mike might have 50 and Mark will have 50 and he'll share all 50 of them. Mike maybe won't share 50. He'll have 50, but he'll tend not to share them because he's looking for the best one in advance. Mike tends to be more analytical than me. I tend to be more off the cuff. Neither one is right or wrong. They're just different. And of course, that's a big part of DISC. Somebody who's different from us isn't bad or good. They're just different. In fact, I've said before at conferences, DISC is a great tool to help us appreciate a different quadrant or a different dimension of diversity, which is behavioral diversity. If everybody looks alike, but we all behave differently, that can be good. If everybody looks differently, but everybody thinks and does the same, that in fact can be bad. And so behavioral diversity can be a real powerful tool. And so DISC basically says this. It says, let me give you an example. Many of us go through our lives, particularly when we're 18 to 20 and beyond, we might ask ourselves, okay, somebody's behaving a certain way toward me and I'm observing them. And I think, gosh, he's doing this. You know what? I know his personality. His personality is this. And so I think he's this kind of person. And we put a couple of labels on him. And then we think in 2 weeks, we think, now I really know how Bob is behaving. I understand his personality. I might even think, I wonder how he was raised. We do this whole inference thing where from someone's behavior, we guess at their personality traits. We put labels on them. Again, we might even guess at how they were raised. We create an entire background picture of them. And we tell ourselves, in 2 weeks when we interact with Bob again, that will help us be more effective with Bob. But all the data show that's not true. Human beings, you listener, the person who's listening to me right now, you are really bad at inferring someone's personality from their behavior, or even worse, trying to infer their how they were nurtured or how they were raised or what their genetic makeup is. You're really bad at guessing that. And then from those inferences, using them to extrapolate a future behavioral set. We know this because there's a lot of evidence, there's a lot of investigation, a lot of experiments that show that very thing. When people make up a story about someone, what their background is, what words you would use, what emotional words, what personality type words you would use, and then you try to predict their behavior in the future, you don't get it very, you're not very accurate. Here's what DISC says. DISC says, if you're bad at it, stop doing it. And frankly, the chances are really good, very high for the vast majority of us, that the behavior we're observing from Bob now is the best indicator of behavior of Bob in the future, which, by the way, this relates very well to behavioral interviewing. And so rather than trying to guess at Bob's personality, rather than trying to guess at how he was raised, rather than trying to guess his background and then extrapolate from that, simply use the behavior as an indicator of what his behavior is going to be in a couple of weeks. And so DISC says your behavior is the clearest indicator. Your behavior now and in the past is the clearest indicator of your future behavior. And DISC asks a series of questions in order to separate anyone who takes a test into a number of different categories that gives you some tendency based on their answers, their tendencies in certain situations. It's four quadrants. You can think of it as a 4x4, as I mentioned, but actually we think of it as a circle. So just cut the corners off of that square and you've got a circle with four quadrants. You've got a horizontal radius and a vertical radius. And that circle with the four quadrants essentially is what we'll talk about when we try to explain how all these things relate to each other. So those of you who don't have show notes, imagine that circle bisect it twice. And I'm going to walk around the four quadrants and talk to you just briefly about it. We're going to start in the top left. So if you're thinking about it as a clock, between 9 and 12 on the clock, that person is a high D. Okay. In the top right, from 12 until 3 o'clock, we have a high I. In the bottom right, 3 to 6 o'clock, we have a high S. And again, we'll explain what all these highs and letters mean in a little bit. And in the bottom left, or in the 6 to 9 category area, we've got a high C. And of course, if you go around the circle, that's D-I-S-C, and that's where the name DISC comes from, okay? All right, so that's the real basics of the model. Let's explain now how the model gets to the behavioral inferences. The model is built on the idea that there are two questions you can ask any human being that tend to separate the environment or the population of human beings pretty evenly on these two questions. The first question is, do you, and by the way, this is not the question that the instrument uses. If you've taken DISC, you'll know this is not a question. This is the science behind the modeling. One of the questions that human beings tend to break pretty evenly on, if you ask enough of them, is how do you see your environment? Do you see your environment as favorable to you or unfavorable to you? And what's important about that is, first of all, human beings, because of the way we are, we're naturally social creatures. The environment for the average human being is not the environment you read about in the paper, but rather the people around that person. Human beings, because we're social creatures, define our environments most often as the people around us, okay? So some people in the world, because of the way their genetic makeup, because of the way they were raised, because of the experiences they had working with other people and playing with other people, they tend to see the environment around them, the people around them, as unfavorable to them, okay? That's about half the world. The other half of the world roughly sees the world as favorable. And that means the people around them is favorable to them. The best way I can describe this is there are some people whom when they first meet somebody, because they see the people around them initially anyway as unfavorable, they keep other people at arm's length. When you first meet a person who sees their environment as unfavorable, they don't trust you. They say, I don't know you yet. I can be polite to you. I can be cordial to you. I'm not going to be rude, but I'm going to put out my arm at arm's length and I'm going to say, no, you're not yet my friend. There might be a little bit of distance yet. There's not probably going to be a great deal of warmth. Okay. Now, there's a great benefit through going through your life for half of the world's population. When they say, no, I'm not going to be best friends the moment I meet you. I'm not going to hug you immediately. I'm going to keep my distance initially. The great benefit of that is when you keep people at arm's length is you're not going to get burned. You're not going to allow somebody to get close to you who shouldn't be, who is hurtful to you or doesn't have your best interests at heart or is not a good person. And you're going to avoid that person because you're going to keep them at arm's length. You're going to get to know them a little bit and you're going to discover this is not a person I want in my life. I don't want to associate this person. I don't want to work with them. I don't want to play with them. I don't want to be their neighbor. And so I'm not going to ever warm up to them and gradually they're going to go away. Great defense mechanism to go through life. And the first thing you do is keep people at arm's length. Okay. There is unfortunately a downside to this choice about keeping people initially at arm's length, being a little bit cool initially until you learn more about the other person. And that is you tend to make less friends. Those people who expect you to be warm to them, in fact, the other half of the world, and feel your distance, feel your arm up in front of you, feel your sense of, no, I'm not yet convinced. I don't trust you yet. They'll say, wow, this person's cold. This person's aloof. This person's not warm. She's not friendly. I'm going to go away. And so what we have is people who keep others at arm's length because they see the environment as unfavorable will tend to be less at risk, but also have less friends. Wendy enjoys my analogy of saying, if you were in a dark alley and you saw somebody down the alley a little bit walking toward you, if you're somebody who sees your environment as unfavorable, you will see that person as a threat. You will think, guard your money, turn around, walk the other way. That person may want to rob me, or maybe they're just nefarious in some way. I don't know who they are. They're certainly not going to help me. That's your first response. It may, in fact, prove wrong, but this is a first response to that interaction. Okay. That's half the people in the world. Okay. The other half of the people in the world see their environment as favorable. And again, environment being the people around us. And folks, just so you know, for those of you who are listening who say, you know, I'm not really a very social person, I like being alone. I'm not going to argue with you, but I can say this. You are hardwired to be a social creature. The limbic part of your brain, the core part of your brain that's been around forever before we developed our wonderful intellectual prowess and so on, that part of your brain wants to be around other human beings. Part of the reason for that is because you can specialize labor. It's easier to go on hunting parties if you have more people. You can also procreate when you're around other people, which you can't do if you're all by yourself. There are all kinds of reasons why human beings like to be together. It's incorrect for you to say that I like being alone exclusively. I don't like being with anybody at any time. We know that some of you prefer being alone more often than other people do. But it is actually a mental illness to say, I want to be alone all the time and I work to be alone all the time. There are cases of people who want to be alone all the time and then become hurtful to other people. It's not normal to say, oh no, that's not me. I'm not that person. I'm not a social person. I don't define my environment that way. You in fact do. You just probably have less of an interest in other people than some people do, but you don't take it to the ultimate extreme. That's a mental illness. Okay. So some people see their environment as favorable. They like hanging out with other people. When they meet another person, they can't imagine in a million years putting their hand out and saying, you know, nope, got to keep you at arm's length. The first thing they do when they meet another person is think this person could be the best friend ever. And they hug the other person, figuratively speaking. They don't keep anybody at arm's length. They think, wow, this person's great. They could be a friend. Let me get to know them. Who knows? They could be important. They could be special. They could be the person I marry. Who knows? And so these people tend to be thought of as naturally friendly and probably naturally, maybe not outgoing, but at least easy to get along with. Okay. Now, there's a great benefit to this in that you make a lot of friends. People are naturally feel it's easy to talk to you. Many people feel drawn to you. They feel they can talk to you. You tend to have more friends. You probably have more Facebook friends. On the other hand, there's a downside to this. If every single person you meet could become your best friend, except maybe rare exceptions, if every single person you meet you're willing to hug and say, come on in, be my friend and have a drink with us, and these are my friends and we're having a great time, those kind of things. Or if you meet them for the first time in a business meeting, you're like, oh, hi, how's it going? You know, thinking to yourself, maybe this person is somebody who could benefit me, or maybe I could help them. Your natural thought is, I want to get to know them. The downside of that is this could be somebody you ought not to be trusting. And because they become your friend and you lower your barriers to them, they then could hurt you easily. They could mislead you. They could lie to you and cause you to do something not effective at work. They could use you. They could ask you for a lot of favors and not return the favors. There are all kinds of things someone who doesn't, whom you don't know very well, could do that would be hurtful to you if you accept them into your circle of friends, if you'll pardon the expression, too quickly. Okay. If you saw somebody, if you're somebody who sees your environment as favorable, who tends to think of most people as generally good, and you want to be their friend when you first meet them. If you saw a person in a dark alley, you'd think, oh, this is somebody I want to meet. Or if you didn't, maybe if you didn't say I wanted to meet them, you would say, oh, if I needed a light, I could go up to them and say I need a light. Or, hey, can you tell me which way to the parking lot? You wouldn't hesitate to approach them. Now, that's probably an extreme. I'm not saying a dark alley at 3 a.m. where you can tell the person perhaps isn't dressed well and is holding something in their hand. But as a general rule, when you meet someone, you're going to think, this person is my friend.
Okay. I was worried. I thought maybe you were going on dark alleys at 3 a.m, friending people.
But, no, okay. Probably not. Good. Probably not. Okay. Now, I think it's important to note that this is not perfect, but it's a tendency. It's an indicator of people's styles of interaction with other people. Now, here's what I want to take this one step further. If you are someone who sees your environment as unfavorable, and so therefore you tend to keep people at arm's length, you're a little bit standoffish until you get to know somebody. Now, by the way, you could end up being the best friend anybody could ever want in the world, but your initial response is again, arm's length. That causes you to not naturally be what some people might call, oversimplification, a people person. You're not naturally a people person. And so therefore, what we find is there's a high correlation between these arm's length people and people who tend to focus on tasks at work. They tend to not think about the people in the room so much as they think about getting the work done. In fact, when HR approaches them and says, you know, we need to do some people initiatives, they'll say something like, no, we don't need to worry about people. What we need to do is worry about the work. And if the work gets done, all the people will be happy because they get to keep their jobs, right? Let's do the work. Let's get the work done. Let's focus on the work. Let's get the work done in the right way. Let's do it effectively and efficiently. Let's build processes and systems to make sure it happens. And if we do that, everybody will get what they need, which is they get to keep a job. And if there's more opportunities, people will get promoted and so on. They focus on tasks. They focus on the work at work. Okay. On the other hand, if you're one of those warm, fuzzy people, oversimplification again, folks, sorry. If you see the environment as favorable, and so therefore you tend to be naturally warm toward other people initially, again, benefits and risks of both sides of the equation, then at work, you tend to be naturally a people person. You focus on the people in the room. You worry about relationships. You create relationships. And what you might say is, hey, let's take care of the people and the work will get done. Okay, those two questions are the left and right half of the disc hemisphere. In fact, there are 4 hemispheres in our discussion today. There's the left one, the right one, the top one, and the bottom one. And the left hemisphere is for those people who see their environment as unfavorable and therefore aren't warm, and so therefore they tend to be task-focused at work. The left side of the circle, the left two quadrants, top left and bottom left, the left hemisphere is for task-focused people. The right hemisphere is for people-focused people. Top right and bottom right are both people-focused folks, okay? In fact, if you don't have premium content, if you're drawing a circle with a quadrant with 4 quadrants by bisecting it horizontally and vertically, what we do is we write the word task on the horizontal axis all the way over at the left where it bisects the circle at 9 o'clock, and we write people over at 3 o'clock to remind us task on the left, people on the right.
So that's the vertical axis, if you will.
That's
why people on the left and right is task and people on the right is people. So what about the horizontal axis that bisects the circle? Let's talk about that.
Yeah. The other question that the creator of DISC essentially asked people in order to get a clear distinction about how people saw that caused a roughly 50-50 split is, how powerful do you feel in the environment you're in? And again, environment being the people around you. Some people describe themselves as feeling more powerful than the environment around them. Some people describe themselves as less powerful than the people around them. Now, when you ask them, you discover often that the people who describe themselves as more powerful than their environment tend to describe the environment as being one or two other people. There might be 50 people in the room, but this person has said, of all these people in the room, here are the two that are most interesting to me, most opposed to me, most in favor of me. And so therefore, when I think of the environment, I'm thinking I've scoped it down to these one or two people. And I see myself as more powerful than them. And power is probably too strong a word, but I believe I can influence them. I believe I can change them. I believe that I can get them to do what I want them to do, however I might be able to do that. In other words, I can influence them in a way that benefits me. Other people, their natural tendency when they're interacting with others is to define the environment as all the people around them, perhaps people not even in the room. And what that tends to do is make them think of themselves as less powerful than their environment. Because if I asked you, Mike, are you more powerful than these other 50 people? You'd say, well, no, I might be more powerful than one or two of them or any one at a time, but not more than 50. And so those people tend to see themselves as less powerful than the human environment around them. It's natural to have these kinds of reactions. And people tend to break pretty evenly between more powerful and less powerful. And there are a lot of you listening who think of yourselves as more powerful, who say to yourself, I can't believe somebody would think themselves, want to be a professional and want to be successful and think of themselves as less powerful than the environment around them. But again, it's not that they think of themselves as unpowerful and not powerful person. They simply define the environment more broadly and recognize that they can't overtake or they can't influence 50 people magically all at once to get them to do what they want them to do. What these two answers to the questions about power relative to the environment cause is a tendency toward types of behaviors. Just like the people who feel the environment is unfavorable tend to be task focused and friendly, the people who see the environment as favorable are people focused. People who see themselves as more powerful than their environment, when put in a new situation, will tend to assert themselves. They will become assertive. If no one's talking in a room, they'll be the one that breaks the silence. If somebody needs to make a decision, they'll say, well, I'll make it. If somebody needs to take some action, they'll say, I'll do it. Other people, because they see themselves as less powerful in the environment, will tend to be reserved. They will say, I'll wait. I'll gather my forces. I'll do some more analysis. I don't want to say anything rash. I'll take my time. I'll dot my I's. I'll cross my T's. I'll make sure my whole team's behind me before we take the appropriate steps. I'll wait and make sure that I can be in a situation that benefits me before I go off half-cocked the way the other half of the world always seems to be doing. And those people who are more powerful than their environment and therefore assert themselves, we put them in the top of hemisphere, the top half of the circle. And we put those people who are reserved in the bottom half of the circle. Top hemisphere is assertive. Bottom is reserved. We write assertive up at the 12 o'clock position and we write reserved at the 6 o'clock position. And the idea there is now you could see we've got four hemispheres, top and bottom, left and right, or as I like to say it, left and right, top and bottom. And then you also have interactions between the hemispheres because there's four quadrants. There's top left, top right, and bottom left. And what happens is when you put together the various connections between assertive and reserved and people and tasks, you get details or subtleties of each of the four quadrants that are worth describing in some detail. Now, I don't want to go into it too much, but I want to give at least a brief overview of what those four quadrants are. If you're in the top left, you're a high D. That D stands for dominance, by the way. We use colors. In fact, Inscape, the company that provides us our tools, our instruments that does the testing, we adopted their colors. And so the green, the high D dominance, we have a green dot for. And the D stands for dominance for a good reason, because a high D top left quadrant from 9 to 12 is, you'll see on the left, so they're task focused and above the line, because they're above the 9-to-3 line. And so they are assertive as well. These are task focused, assertive people. High D's tend to be, if you'll pardon the expression, take no prisoners, make it happen. A little bit of blood on the floor will be fine. Let's get it done. If you need the tough mission done, give it to me. I'll get it done. I might break some china, but you can count on me. The work will get it done. Now, that approach to life works a lot in certain situations. It doesn't work in church. It doesn't work when sensitivity is required. It doesn't work when analysis is required or when people relationships are required. But if you need something done, the high D is often the person who will not only want to do it in order to get ahead themselves, but also will be good to do it. The high I, again, we're still above the line here. We're from the 12-to-3 on the clock. We're in the top right quadrant. And now the high I is assertive because he's on the top or she's on the top, just like the high D. But now they flipped over to the other side of the vertical line and they're people focused. So they're the high I, which is a red dot, by the way, and the I stands for influence. The high I is assertive and people focused. And this is the salesperson in the room. This is the friendly, outgoing, hi, I'm Mark Rush, chairman, damn glad to meet you. Always friendly, always warm, always has a sparkle in their eyes, dresses well, moves quickly, makes lots of friends, probably a little bit messy doing it, but everybody likes them. They look well, they speak well. They're overrepresented in TV talk show hosts that have to look well and talk right into the camera and put their sentences together well and so on. Again, they're assertive just like high D's, but they tend to focus on people. They like to create teams and they love to sit around and work together, achieving great things. If you continue going around the circle, the high S is S standing for steadiness, and they have a blue dot. The color is blue. The high S is a people-focused person, just like the high I. They're on the right side of the quadrant from 3 until 6 o'clock, bottom right quadrant. They tend to be people-focused, but they're reserved because they're below the line from 3 to 9. Okay, they're below the line. S stands for steadiness, and they are the team players among us. They are the grandmothers and the grandfathers, the team mothers, the team fathers on any given team. They always know how everybody's doing. They're always asking how everybody's doing. Their famous line is, enough about me. Let's talk about you. Here, have a cookie. They want to be warm and friendly to you. They have lots of friends, just like high eyes. They tend to be not as outspoken. They tend to be more reserved, but you can turn to them. You can talk to them, and they always have a finger on the pulse of how the people are doing in an organization. Very warm. The word that's often used about high S's is warm. And then lastly, continuing around the circle, we have high C's. Again, we're just talking very briefly. This tends to be, they're reserved the way high S's are because they're also below the line. But now we've gone from to the 6-to-9 position on the clock. And so we flipped back over to the left side of the hemispheres, the left side of the clock, and they're reserved like S's, but they're also task focused like the high D's. The C, who has a yellow dot. C stands for conscientiousness. These are the perfectionists among us. They like to worry about the work. They don't worry about people. They dot their I's. They cross their T's. They believe a little bit more data is always better. They don't think about people all that much. They think about the work getting done and following processes and following systems and behaviors and so on. And they believe that more time spent getting something right, correct, accurate, perfect is always a good use of their time. The engineers, the accountants, the IT people of the world, they like things done right, period. They're the quality mavens of the world.
Okay? Yeah. Thank God.
And that's probably, yeah, and they're reserved and tight. Yeah, thank God, yeah. Folks, if you don't know a lot about DISC, Mike and I kind of joke. I happen to have two tendencies. I'm a high D and a high I. Probably in listening to this, you could have figured that out. And Mike is a high D, high C. It's not unusual. There are many people who have just one of the tendencies as a primary. Some people have two. Mike and I both have two. He is a DC. I'm a DI. And we share the high D. We're willing to take risks and move forward. But the difference is he tends to be more of a C and I tend to be more of an I, which is interesting at our company because at Manager Tools and Career Tools, because I's and C's often struggle to get along, just like D's and S's struggle to get along. If you're the further away you are from somebody on the in the quadrants or in the circle, the harder it is for you to naturally get along. Sometimes
now I understand.
Yeah, oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, so Mike tends to be a little bit slower, a little bit more careful. I tend to be a little bit faster and a little bit more impetuous. He gets pissed off at me because I make decisions he thinks rashly. I get pissed off at him because he takes too long. Neither one is right. They're just different. Sometimes his approach is better. Sometimes my approach is better. I think actually 51% of the time my approach is better. Right, Mike? Isn't that right?
I thought it was the other way around, but I don't know. Wait a minute. Matter of fact, I have the data to prove that it's the other way
around. Oh, yes. Okay, great.
You're just making crap up. So.
Yeah, I probably am.
Okay, so that's a good explanation of the disk from this kind of circular perspective. But when you get the disk profile itself, when you take it with Inkscape and you get it, there's a page that has another different graph that right. I'm sure that is connected to the circular one, but different nonetheless. Tell me about that.
Yeah, okay, good. So the circular graph is an easier way. You'll use it more for the once you start paying attention to disk, and we encourage you to do it. Mike and I use it all the time. It is, and I'll tell you something, folks, it is the single most important information about communication I've ever learned in my life. It's the single most important bit of knowledge that I remember as a singular bit of knowledge in my entire professional career. Understanding how other people tend to communicate and being willing to modify my behavior is stunning, the difference it's made in my life. And I didn't learn it until late in my career in the Army. Okay. So the circular graph is going to be easy to sort of think about the connections between D and I and D and C and I and S and so on. But the vertical graph makes it easy for us to understand what some people's number scores are. If you have the vertical graph and you know somebody's four number score, you're going to be able to quickly graph them, and the graph will give you clues as to their tendencies when you interact with them. Okay. So what happens is you're going to take this 28 question test and it's going to give you this vertical graph. It's going to score you in relative amounts of tendencies toward D, I, S, and C, those four quadrants we just talked about. Okay. And for each of the four areas, you're going to get a score from 1 to 7. The way they represent it is this vertical graph on page 3. And if you don't have your profile in front of you, you're driving to work or home from work or whatever, or you're mowing the yard or doing laundry or whatever, think of four vertical lines that are scored from 1 to 7. There's no 0 and there's no 8. And so almost like four sticks or four pieces of bamboo standing up in front of you. And each one of them is the same height. And from left to right, you can label them D, I, S, and C. Okay. In the middle, think about it, from 1 to 7, 1, 2, and 3 are below the middle, 4 is the middle, and 5, 6, and 7 are above the middle. And so on page 3, you'll notice if you actually can look at it, the number 4, the scores that are in the 4 band there in the middle are actually gray. It shows you that the 4 is the middle of this vertical scoring system that they've used. So once someone tells you their four numbers, let's say my numbers are 7, 7, 1, 1, you can quickly plot that 7, my first number 7, because it's a D, and it's because it's the D is on the left, I would put a dot on my leftmost vertical graph at the top, at the 7. I would do the same thing for the I, because I'm a 7, 7, 1, 1. So I'd have 2 7s on the 2 left bars and 2 1s on the bottom right bars. Okay. If you picture that in your head, 2 high numbers on the left followed by 2 low numbers on the left, and you connect them with at first a horizontal line between the D and I roughly, and then a very steep fall to the S number, which is a 1, and then across again horizontal to the C, it looks like a staircase, only a really, really tall, very narrow staircase. The moment you know someone's four number score, you can quickly graph their score. Now, some people, I will tell you, don't ever translate the numbers to the graph, because if I told you I was a 7, 7, 1, 1, and you know that's a D, I, S, and C score, you could say, well, I don't have to draw that mark. I don't have to graph it. I know that a 7 is big. The 2 7s are high and the 2 1s are low. And since the first two letters are always D, I, right, I know that you're a high D and a high I. But if you see someone's graph, immediately you'll be able to infer and get a rough sense of what their tendencies are and so on. And so having the numbers, being able to draw the graph, will give you a quick sense of what a person's tendencies are. And at some point you'll get so good that when somebody tells you their numbers, you'll say, aha, I know that a 6116, if you'll picture that, that looks kind of like an angular U or an angular, maybe even a V. And so if you saw that, you would say, aha, the 6 is above 4, because if someone has a 5, 6, or 7, we call them high in that skill or that tendency. And if they have a 1, 2, or 3, they're low in that tendency. So somebody with a 6116, the shape of the graph is going to be like a U, or maybe somebody would say a bucket with sides that are at an angle. And the two high scores are the far left and the far right graph. And so we would say they're a high D, high C. And you could also say they're a low I, low S, but we generally don't focus on the low letters or the low tendencies. We focus on the major tendencies. In your case, Mike, what's your graph?
I'm a 7316.
Okay, so 7, so up high, high D like me, right? Top left of that vertical graph we're talking about, 7316. It looks like a V, or maybe a little bit of a U, and the 3 and the 1 at the bottom makes the bottom of the V or the U a little bit unsymmetrical. What's important about that, folks, Mike scored 7316. Hopefully you can see it if you graph it in your head. The 7 and the 6 for the D and the C are high. He's got that U shape or that V shape, and the moment you know somebody's a V shape, you can pretty well guess probably a high D, high C. And again, you could probably, based on the thing I just shared a few minutes ago, you could say, oh, that means he tends to be task focused. He tends to make things happen. He may be a little bit analytical, and you'd be right. Different graph shapes mean different things about people. So the moment I give you a graph, the moment I give you four numbers, if you understand the vertical graphs, these four equally tall vertical lines with scores from 1 on the bottom to 7 at the top and 4 is in the middle. If I told you somebody was a 2, 7, 6, 1, you could probably draw, I'll give you a second to think about it, you could probably draw an upside down V or U and say, aha, that person is, because they're high in the middle of the vertical graphing style, they're a high I and a high S. Their number for I, 7, and their number for S, 6, are both above 4, and so we would call that person a high I, high S. We want you to understand that vertical graphing because it's in your profile on page 3. Again, if you've got your profile from us, there are different companies who use DISC in different ways. They may not show you this vertical graph, but you get it from Inkscape. It's a quick way to think about it. And we really like the way Inkscape delivers a DISC. And we like the size of the database with the data they have that shows millions and millions of tests, I'm sure, and doing all kinds of tests constantly to make sure that their data and their conclusions about the data are accurate. And if you have somebody's four numbers, you can quickly draw their graph, and you, as long as you know which ones are over 4, you know which tendencies they have, which are they tend to be more like that tendency. If somebody has a score of their first number is a 7, then they're going to be a high D, and that means there are going to be times when they're going to assert themselves, they're going to be forceful, they're going to be maybe a little rough around the edges, but they're going to be somebody who takes action. If they have a high C, if they're a 6 on that last score, or a 5, a 6, or 7 on the last score, they're going to tend to be a little bit more analytical. They're going to take their time. They're going to go slow in certain situations. And they're going to be task-focused like the high Ds. They're not going to probably be as warm as fuzzy as those people who have higher scores in the middle two of the four vertical graphs. Probably overtalked that a little bit. The point is, if you know the numbers, you can graph them. Or if you see someone's graph, you know what the graph means based on what it means to be high or low in a given tendency. Now, the other thing that's on there is you'll notice at the bottom of your graph, if you're looking at it, there are four numbers. And those numbers, of course, correspond to where the dots are on the graphs. And then below those four numbers, there's a block with a word in it. And it says, to the right of it, it says classical pattern. Okay. The word may be confusing to you. Don't put too much stock in the typical everyday use or meaning of that word. Mike's score of 7316 is what is known a classical pattern of creative. there's no evidence that Mike is, and that sounds terrible the way I'm saying it.
Yeah, it does, actually. Thanks.
There's no evidence that Mike is more or less creative than anybody else in the world. And the point we're trying to make here is we don't want you to get too excited or unexcited about the meaning of that particular word. We want you to understand that they're labeling, that that's labeling the interactions between all of your numbers. And it really is just a roadmap to get you to the back of the book that Inkscape provides. Again, if you don't have an Inkscape test, I don't know how it's presented to you, but if you're creative, you would go to the back of the book. It's between pages 15 and 22, and you would be able to find alphabetically in the C's, creative starts with a C, the classical profile that connects the relationship between 7316, which is Mike, and you could see what that classical pattern means in terms of it, more in-depth information about who you are, or actually not who you are, but how you tend to behave. DISC does not say who you are. It does not say who you can become. It is not a label for the rest of your life. It's one of the things we like about it as opposed to, say, Myers-Briggs. It only says this is how you tend to behave when you're not thinking about behaving. The real beauty of DISC, of course, is we've said hundreds of thousands of times now at all of our conferences, and I think we've said it in our cast as well, is it only says what you do, your tendency, when you're not thinking about behaving, when you're a little bit on autopilot, which a lot of us are most of the time. The great thing about DISC is you can behave any way you want if you think about it first. When I interact with Mike, because I know he has a different pattern than me, I tend to change my behavior slightly to keep our worst tendencies from getting in the way of one another. In other words, I don't tell him, hey, I'm going to go do this thing and, you know, I'm just going to do it and see what happens. I don't do that because he thinks that's impetuous. I think it's being creative and a little bit crazy, but maybe it'll turn out good and who cares anyway. If it goes bad, it'll be fine. We'll fix it. Whereas Mike would rather dot the I's and cross the T's and let's have a plan. So I don't say to Mike, oh, I'll just go do it. I say to him, hey, listen, let's talk about this. Let's make sure we're on the right, on the same wavelength. I find that not natural. I can do it. I can be good at it, but I have to think about it first. By the same token, when I call Mike and I have an idea, Mike's natural response is to analyze the idea, to provide feedback about the idea, what's good and what's bad, what the strengths and weaknesses are, and so on. He's learned that I want him to support me. And so what he's learned to do is when I give him an idea, even if it's way out there, he says, I love the thinking. I think it's really interesting about this and this and this. Great idea, dude. And hey, do you want some help? Do you want to refine it? And I'll say, sure, I'm happy to. And then he gets into, well, there's a problem with this and there's a problem with that and a problem and so on. He's learned how to modify his behavior to be effective with me.
Most of the time.
Well, and same with me. With me with you, right? We're not perfect. We've known each other for 30 years and we're still not perfect. We're still working at it. Okay. The issue here, folks, is any one of you listening right now can be a lot more effective in any situation if you'll start paying attention to other people's behavioral patterns and be willing to modify yours slightly to be effective. And this is something I say at all the conferences. If you're not willing to modify your behavior, DISC is neat to learn about yourself. It'll confirm who you are, and that's about all. It's kind of neat. The whole point of growth and development is learning how to be effective in different situations, and only some of the situations you're going to come across in your life are naturally related in a way that will make it easy for you to do it by using your natural tendencies. There are some situations that will call on things that are not natural to you. I like to joke that I can open a spreadsheet, I can create a spreadsheet, I can make a big complicated spreadsheet. I don't like spreadsheets terribly much, but I know that I have to look at them for the finances of manager tools and for clients and so on. And so I can be very good at it. It's not my natural tendency. And so I have to think about it, prepare for it. I have to work a little bit harder than somebody else who just loves to look at spreadsheets all day. Neither one is right or wrong. It's just helpful to know your own tendency and then be willing to modify your behavior in order to be more effective.
So you've already gotten into a little bit our next point, which is what can you do with this information, right?
Yeah, this is really where we think manager tools and career tools make an enormous difference in terms of DISC, because so many people are, when they get trained on DISC, they learn about themselves. And they all have this wonderful aha. If you're listening and you've got your profile, if you've read in the back of the book, you'll say, wow, that's incredible. I can't imagine that 28 questions will get me that much detail. But it is incredibly helpful that you'll learn that. But if that's all you learn, it just tells you something about yourself that just proves how cool the instrument is. But it doesn't really give you any ability to be more effective, because to be more effective, folks, think about it. Whatever level you're effective at now, you're not going to be more effective if you don't change, right? Insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. And in fact, if you stay the way you are and the world around you changes, you will become less effective even more quickly than you realize. So we've got to learn to change. And a big part of working in most organizations is working with other people. As the joke goes, the recruiter, when he's told by the young person, I really want a job working with people, the recruiter says, well, that's good, because all the jobs with dogs and trees in our company are taken. You're going to have to work with other people, and you're going to have to learn about other people. And it's not just you asserting yourself or you just hanging back. It's you learning that in certain situations, certain behaviors are more effective. And with certain people, certain behaviors, certain tendencies are more effective. And you can learn them. It's just behavior. You'll be uncomfortable doing it, but you'll be more effective. So basically what we're getting at here is DISC is not designed just to categorize people. Again, it tells you how to behave when you're not thinking about it, and it tells you how others tend to behave when they're not thinking about it, assuming that you would know their profile, right? In fact, everybody always behaves in certain patterns, and if you learn the patterns and are able to infer their tendencies based on their behaviors, you'll be able to predict in the future what they'll do, and you can modify your behavior. In case you're thinking this is an awful lot of effort, right? We're giving you way more detail than probably most people will. There are two things we've learned from teaching and practicing this with thousands and thousands of people. One is, if you'll pay attention to somebody else's tendencies and note that they're different than yours, moving towards someone else's behavior, in other words, think about what they think is, what their natural tendencies are, what they think is important, and adapting to them, moving in their direction. For me, let's say I'm talking to Mike, being a little bit more analytical than normal, not being quite as impetuous, knowing he's going to expect some data from me before we go off half-cocked. Moving toward them will make communicating easier with them. It'll make them easier for you to understand, and they will like you more and they will understand you better when you communicate with them. Again, you can actually work on clicking with someone over time. That's the ultimate oversimplification. I clicked with him. I don't know what happened, but I clicked with him or her. But if you work at it, you can create a situation where even though you weren't naturally alike in terms of your behavioral tendencies, over time, people will say, wow, we really get along well. And in fact, you'll be thinking to yourself, yeah, I worked at it. I paid attention to your tendencies and I modified my tendencies in order to be more effective. And this is the heart of what you can do with DISC. DISC gives you a way to learn about other people and change your behavior to be more effective with them. Far too many people that Mike and I work with, executives, managers, people all walks of life, everywhere in the world, far too many people say, I want to be me. And if you're working with someone who's different than you and you're unwilling to change, you're putting your personal preference, avoiding change, over effectiveness that can come from being willing to modify your tendencies in order to communicate more clearly and gain agreement with and develop a plan with and work together with somebody else who has a different style than you. And folks, 75% of the world has a different style than you, if you think about just simply the four quadrants. And by the way, the world is roughly equally spread in the four different quadrants. The world of executives is not roughly spread, but the world population, there's roughly an equal amount of D's, I's, S's, and C's. If you move toward another person because you understand their tendencies and those tendencies make sense to them, you make it more likely that they'll understand you. This is not manipulation. It's you modifying your own behavior to be more effective. In the same way that if you think about a presentation you have to give and you're thinking, okay, the board members, I know there's a big issue, but we're really tight on cost right now. So I've got to make sure that the part of my presentation on cost is really, really clear and concise and yet detailed. A year or two later, the company might be flush with cash and you got to say, you know what? I don't need to worry so much about costs this time. I've got to worry about how I can show them there's going to be a big payoff for this, even though there's also a big investment. Okay. Well, you'll modify that. And maybe the new CEO is a salesperson and the last CEO was an accountant. And so you'd present differently to those two people. You can apply that same kind of logic with incredible accuracy, thanks to this profile. If you know somebody else's profile, you can apply that in all situations when you're working with other people. You're going to be more successful collaborating with other people. And in today's world, with less focus on manager power and more focus on relationship power and collaborative or interaction and team decision-making and so on. If you have a team that's all different and you don't work to try to mitigate some of those differences, understand the differences and change your behavior slightly so that you can, again, mitigate them, you're not going to interact with them well. And the team is not going to produce great results. DISC is actually an analytical tool to help you be more collaborative with people, particularly when they're different than you. It's hugely important. I consider the underlying principle of you can change your behavior if you have enough data, if you're willing to pay attention to it, really watch other people's behaviors. I consider that to be one of the most important underlying scientific ideas of the next 30 or 40 years in the business world.
Yeah.
I know that probably overstates it, but I use DISC every day, all the time. And over and over and over again, it's proven to me to be true. It's not perfect because there's only 28 questions and there's 7 billion people in the world, right? You can't accurately characterize somebody perfectly, but you can get a really good instance. I like to tell people that DISC may not make you perfect, but it'll reduce the chances that you're going to be dead wrong by like 90%. It will reduce the chances you'll have a glaring failure working with somebody who's notably different than you. If I were going to work with somebody who's a high C and I were nothing but a high I, and I walked into the room and stuck out my hand and say, hey, how's it going? And I leaned back in my chair and says, we're going to have a great time on this. It's going to be a great time. Let's go have a drink. We'll get to know each other. And the high C sitting across from me with his deck of data and his stack of reports and everything looks at me like, this is going to be awful. I'm going to hate this.
Yeah. Exactly.
But if I know who he is, I can say, okay, I got to dot my I's and cross my T's. I got to be ready. I got to have my ducks in a row a little bit. Not my natural tendency in interacting with other people, in a meeting or something like that. And yet I know if I do it, I'm much more likely to get better results. I do want to cover one more thing before we move on and talk about the four styles. I mentioned page 3 of the Inscape document. If you go to the very back, the pages 15 through 22, if you want the most detailed analysis of the interaction of the four numbers that you have, I think there are something like 15 or 16 or 18 classical patterns in the back of the book. But between pages 15 and 22 are the classical patterns. Do take a few minutes when you get a chance and read your classical pattern, which is indicated by the word creative or inspirational or results oriented or appraiser or those words. Go to the back of the book, find your pattern and read it, and you'll probably find that to be unerringly accurate. Now, I'll also tell you something else. When we teach DISC, we don't teach you that you need to know someone's classical pattern. In fact, I don't even know the details of Mike's classical pattern when I interact with him because the amount of data there, the amount of information is really too much for me to use on a day-to-day basis. There's just too much detail there for me. On the other hand, I do know that Mike is a high D, high C, and I use that information all the time when I'm talking to Mike. So I want to just point out that the classical patterns, that we encourage people to read them in the back of the book.
Good.
Okay, so I know we get cautious here because we're going to go through some vignettes of the four different styles, and we don't want to, how many billion souls are there on the planet, and everybody's different and unique, and they have their own soul. And so we're not saying this is not who you are. These are some general tendencies that folks in each of the quadrants tend to make. So let's don't make more of it than it is.
Yeah.
So that said, this is always one of my favorite parts of the Effective Communications Conference when we go through this in detail, because I think it's terribly interesting and terribly useful in terms of being able to identify, one, how people tend to view you and your behaviors, as well as helping you to identify other quadrants that you don't necessarily fit into, identify their behaviors and be able to quickly identify folks. Because, obviously you don't walk up to somebody on the street and say, hey, would you take this behavioral profile thing? Just log on to this website and answer these questions, and then I'll be able to interact with you. And the fact is, you don't have to do that to be able to interact with folks and communicate with folks better.
Yeah. You know, it brings up a good point. You mentioned there are 7 billion souls on the earth. This is one way to think about interacting with other people, behavioral, how people tend to behave. This is not a judgment. It's not designed to separate people. It is designed to appeal to the human mind's interest in understanding how people are different without putting labels on people. Let me just walk you through a high level thing. There are as many high Ds who are short as there are tall, all things being equal, right? There are no more high Ds or high Ss among Muslims than there are among Christians than there are among Buddhists. Poor people, rich people, Caucasian, tall, young, old, people from Micronesia, people from Antarctica, people from Brazil. There are no differences across the world culturally. Now, I just realized I've opened up a whole nother can of worms, which are people are going to say, no, wait, Mark, wait. Americans are much more cowboyish. Not true, folks. The data that the DISC folks have shows that there are no distinctions among national groupings. Okay. There are as many percentage-wise high Ds in Japan as there are in the U.S. U.S. people are not more high D than, let's say, Mexicans or Canadians or the French or the people from Kazakhstan. It's just not true. Okay. Those are cultural biases. In fact, oftentimes we find when I'm working with international groups that it is the biases that get in the way of us in terms of people. Let's say a good example, an American goes to Europe and is working for a French and a German, and he assumes the German is engineer and he assumes the French want to be in charge, right? Stupid labels that may in fact be false. And often are false. And so he tends to interact with a label or a stereotype and then wonders why it doesn't work. I'll even go further. He interacts with a label. And when he's interacting, if he meets the German, and or, by the way, Mike, right now I'm thinking about our good friend Thomas Hausmann and another one, Gernot, who if I believe they are a certain type, that suggestion causes me to look for behavior to support my point of view. And so there are people listening right now goes, I can't believe he didn't say that Americans were more cowboyish, because that's been my experience. Folks, I promise you the data are overwhelming. We have a cast on it called the Windy Curve. There is no evidence. The demographics between national groupings are essentially equal when you grade them on behavioral tendencies, on interpersonal behaviors. They're equal. If I drew you a graph about the relative distribution of, say, leadership or management skills of French versus Moroccan versus a Libyan versus American, they would all be within a hair's breadth of one another. You could not tell one from the other. There is no significant statistical difference. Okay. And if I think Thomas Hausmann is an engineer, who in fact he is, but if I'm working with a coworker of his and I assume he's an engineer, I look for things that make me think he's an engineer, which supports my own bias, which is a stereotype. I often say at conferences, I say to the women at our conferences, I say, how would you feel if I managed you like a woman, like all the other women I've ever managed? I mean, I get some pretty nasty looks. And that's my point. We would never interact with someone's tendencies. We always interact with the person. Knowing the tendency is helpful in terms of avoiding some behaviors that won't go over well. And it's helpful in giving you clues to how you can communicate with them and how you can present to them and how you can exchange data with them and how to plan with them and so on. But you're still interacting with a person. And that person is important. That person is, as I like to say at a conference, a human soul worthy of respect. And I can't imagine a less respectful thing than me talking to a woman or somebody from Brazil and interacting with them as if they are a woman, a cardboard cutout of a woman, or interacting with them the way I do all Brazilians. They could literally consider that an affront to themselves as a person. In other words, I'm interacting with a label of them. And by the same token, I can't imagine a higher form of respect than me paying close attention to how they tend to interact, paying close attention to how they talk to me, and trying to communicate back to them in a way that will help them understand me. I tend to talk pretty fast. That's partly because I'm a high D and a high I. It's also partly because of my job. But because of that, if I'm interacting with a high S or a high C, I know I have to slow down my communication. I don't slow it down because they're an S or a C. I slow it down because their tendency is to communicate more slowly. And if I communicate too fast, I'm one, asserting myself over their interests, and B, or two, I'm running the risk of them not understanding me. Why would I bother talking if they're not going to understand me? It's a waste of time. So DISC is a way to help us see everyone's own individuality by giving you some tendencies that people tend to have, and it gives you a way to watch and pay attention to another person's behaviors. So please, these are not labels. It's a way to help you think about, to begin to separate the various styles that people have, but ultimately you're still interacting with an individual. Okay, so let's talk about high Ds, yeah? People who are high Ds love to get immediate results. They like making quick decisions. They're assertive and they're task-focused. They want to take authority. They want to cause action. They'll take no prisoners. They'll push their, if you need a man for a secret and dangerous mission, this is a famous quote about West Point football players in World War II, then you want a high D. They're active in dealing with problems and challenges. They come to work every day thinking, I've got three things I've got to solve and I'm going to solve them. I've got three big problems and I'm going to break them down into smaller ones and I'm going to win and I'm going to take the hill, right? People often describe them as demanding, as forceful. Sometimes they're described as egocentric because they're willing to go forward even if it hurts other people's feelings. They're strong-willed. They tend to be driven. People say about them they're driven, they're determined, they're ambitious, they're aggressive. They take off after objectives. They start things and they're not at all worried about starting in the wrong direction, going, okay, that's not working. Let's change and go in a different direction. They're totally comfortable taking charge. Unfortunately, some people do see them as intimidating, right? They're always taking action. They're willing to rub people the wrong way. And they'd say, look, in order to make an omelet, you got to break a few eggs, okay? Classic high Ds. The classic one in the 20th century is George Patton, the American general from World War II, very willing to do whatever it takes to get the objective accomplished. You know, the high Ds that you see in professional football, American football, sorry, those of you who are football fans in the rest of the world, they tend to be the ones that are the football coaches, the ones that tend to be yelling and screaming. Sir Alex Ferguson, let's go to a different type of football, is not a high D based on his demeanor on the side of the pitch. High Ds are often seen as insensitive and impatient. They want to get things done. They want to get things done fast. They think you ought to be enough of an adult to not worry when I didn't intend to hurt your feelings. If your feelings got hurt, well, sorry, your feelings got hurt. They're willing to tell you what to do. They'll tell you your role. They'll tell you the deadline. They speak quickly. They interrupt. In fact, they'll often in their head say, I interrupted now. You ought to stop talking. They don't mind if you interrupt them. They think that's just faster. They tend to make big gestures. They make eye contact with you. They don't smile a lot. In fact, both Ds and Cs tend to have a tendency of not smiling because they're not naturally people persons. Is and Ss tend to be more the smilers. And they often come across as a little bit distracted because they're in their mind, they have two or three things they have to get done or one thing they're going to get done. And other people are like, wow, they're not paying attention to me. I wonder if they're distracted. Yes, they're not paying attention to you. They're distracted by the goal they have in their head that they're not going to leave work without accomplishing. If you need a hill taken and it is literally, it cannot not be taken. In other words, it has to be done. Give that job to a high D because he or she will get it done. That's high Ds.
Okay.
And again, the D stands for dominance.
Okay. How about I's, the influencers?
Yeah. Okay. So high I's, again, assertive, but now people focused, right? They love to work with other people. They love to reach out and talk to other people. High I's are the marketing and the salespeople of the world. They're always sticking out their hands and say, hi, I'm Mark. How are you? Nice to meet you. Tell me about you. What do you do? The high I is the chatty person who sits next to you on a plane. And if you're a high D or a high C and you've been irritated periodically by somebody sitting next to you on a plane and saying, hey, where are you going? What are you doing? And so on. that was a high I. And by the way, those of us who are I's think we're being friendly and you think we're being a pain in the ass, pardon me. And
you think we're a stick in the mud, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's a classic case where two different natural tendencies interact ineffectively. And, you know, if you're a high eye, you need to learn to pay more attention to people's clues. And when people look away from you and look down at their book and turn a page in a book, you need to stop talking to them because they don't want to talk to you. You can't imagine someone not wanting to talk to you as a high eye, but in fact, there are people, half of the people in the world don't naturally want to talk to you. High eyes are convincing. They're thought of as magnetic. They're enthusiastic. They talk loud. They talk fast. They have a smile on their face almost all the time. They love to inspire and motivate other people. They tend to come across as pretty articulate. You'll see a lot of them on talk shows, on TV talk shows. They like group work. I got a great idea. Let's all sit down and brainstorm about it. And they'll have a great time brainstorming. And then maybe they won't be as good about following up, and they won't come with out of the meeting with deliverables, and they'll go from brainstorming new ideas to brainstorming new ideas without ever actually following through. There's a great quote about high eyes that they're the people who put their best foot forward and then drag their other foot behind. They're the kind of people who it can be said he could sell snow to Eskimos. They like to work in groups. In fact, if they're not getting something done, another person in the room listening and watching them is sometimes enough to get them to concentrate. They know they're being watched and they want to look good. They're a little bit disorganized. They're the ones who never have the right paper with them, and their desk is probably messy. Probably a lot of pictures of them and other people around their desk. I remember years ago, somebody walked in my office and said, "My God, there's 100 pictures on the wall." And I realized, whew. You know, I had a lot of pictures of me and my friends and my family on the wall. I mean, literally 6 feet high and 8 feet wide of nothing but 3x5 and 4x6 and 5x7, 8x10 pictures of me and my family and friends, which is a little bit much, right? But it didn't seem like much of my. I said, here's another great picture. I want to put that on the wall. I want it to be right behind my desk so I can look at them whenever I want. But when this person pointed it out, by the way, a high C, I was like, whoa, okay, maybe too much.
If I had five, I would think I'd be pushing it. But hey, that's the difference between you and I.
Yeah, it's just it's a difference. And neither one is wrong or right. They're just different. And when you walk into somebody's office and they have 50 pictures on the wall and you kind of go, oh, I wouldn't do that, you're missing an opportunity. You're judging them, folks, rather than saying, aha, this person's a people person. I need to make sure I talk about my family, or I need to be willing to have some chit-chat. People persons are naturally wanting chit-chat before they get down to business. If you walk into somebody's office and they have 50 pictures on the wall and you say, okay, let's get right down to it, they're going to be like, whoa, Who put you in charge of my time? Where's the warmth? Where's the fuzzy? Where's the, hey, how's it going? How is that mocha latte frappuccino you're drinking? High eyes, they're assertive. They'll tell you what they want to do. They may go off on a tangent. There's a movie that came out a year or two ago called Up. It's a cartoon movie. I think it's from Disney or Pixar, where a man puts balloons on his house and floats away. And his dog or somebody's dog in the movie is fitted with a collar that allows it to speak in human voice. And of course, what do dogs do in their head throughout the, what does he do throughout the movie? He's like constantly saying, squirrel. High eyes are often seen as distracted and in the middle of a discussion go squirrel and they're off on another tangent. They talk about themselves a lot. They're willing to share with other people relationships that they have. They're very open communicator. High D's and high C's think of it as way too much information, you know, like sort of like verbal vomit. They don't like it. They talk fast. They talk loud. They'll interrupt you. They're willing to hug you. They shake your hand, then hug you, then slap you on the back and then say, oh, come on, let's end with a hug, right? And they smile like you're their best friend all the time. That's high eyes. A classic high eye would be Katie Couric, who is a morning talk show host. Most of the morning talk show hosts tend to be, at least in the U.S., I actually watched some German talk show, morning talk show a couple of years ago, and they were more like high D's or high C's, very blank-faced. The American morning talk show hosts, for those of you who travel in America, are classic, tend to be much more high I's. Very friendly, bubbly, outgoing. That's a high I.
Good. Okay. How about high S's, steadiness? What are they like?
Right. So high S shares that people interest with the high I's, but now we're going to go below the line to that 3 to 6 o'clock position. And so they're going to be reserved while they're people focused. They're great team players. They're very empathetic, sensitive to the needs of other people. They're the grandmother, the grandfather, the den mother, the den father, the team mom, the team dad. They're always paying attention to how everybody else is doing. When you come into their cube, they say, oh, how are you? How's it going? Don't worry about me. How are you? How are you doing? Have a cookie, right? They're great listeners. They're very patient. They're very loyal. They love stability and consistency. Okay. They want steadiness. They don't like change. In fact, we didn't talk about this much. D's and I's love creating change. S's and C's like to avoid change and in some cases try to resist change. D's and I's create too much change. S's and C's say no to change too often, probably. Neither one is right or wrong unless it's taken to its extremes. S's tend to be methodical. They're predictable. Unfortunately, because they avoid change, even though they're warm and fuzzy, other people tend to see them as indecisive. They want to take more time. They want to ask. They want to assess the impact on the team of this new change. They come across as indirect. They would never tell you something to your face that they thought might hurt your feelings. And so they'll allude to something. And then 2 days later, you'll realize what they were telling you. And those high Ds are like, why didn't she just say to me? Why didn't he just say to me something so that I would know that I was off on the wrong tangent? Well, they don't want to hurt your feelings. They don't want to be too direct. They don't want to be too assertive. They want to give you the opportunity to figure it out on your own. Again, they're a little bit resistant to change. They don't tend to assert themselves. They like to ask questions rather than making statements. They use the phrase we, and they talk about you a lot rather than talking about themselves. They don't say I nearly as much as they say we or you. They love to chat. They love to share relationships. They'll tend to talk softer and slower. They'll smile a lot when they're talking, and they'll wait for agreement. They'll make a statement, and they'll ask you whether or not that's what you needed to know. Okay. They love to ask for feedback, literally, about what they just said. They tend to make smaller gestures. They make less eye contact than the D's and I's, who, frankly, D's wish their eyes had laser beams shooting out of them so they could just kill everyone around them and then be at the top of the heap because there's nobody else on the heap. But S's are just the opposite. They'll listen, they'll smile, they'll totally focus on you when you're interacting with them. Whereas D's, who are the opposite of S's in many ways, tend not to do that. They won't focus on you. They'll focus on getting the work done, and you just happen to be a cog in the system.
Excellent. Now, we just finished talking about D's and S's, and I's and S's being on the right-hand side or people focus. So let's go back over to the left-hand side of the circle, the left hemisphere, and talk about high C's, who are both reserved and task-focused.
Yes, exactly. They share the reservedness with the high S's, who are in the 3-6 position, and they share the task focus with the high D's, who are in the 9-12 position. High C's are in the 6-9 position, the bottom left quadrant, left hemisphere, bottom hemisphere. The high C's are the engineers, the accountants, the dot your I's, cross your T's people. I had a person say to me once, this person is a belt and suspenders person. And just so you know, this cast is not about fashion, but folks, if you quote are a belt and suspenders person, just to be wrong, feel free to wear two pair of shoes and two pair of socks and two shirts because belts and suspenders are not meant to be worn together. That said, high C's would say, well, better safe than sorry, right? They tend to be thorough. They tend to be accurate. There's an old saying, I should have said this before, Mike. We often do this at conferences, the old phrase, ready, aim, fire. The translation for ready, aim, fire for all four of the quadrants is kind of fun. We do this at the conference. The high D translates ready, aim, fire as fire, right? Let's not get ready. Let's not aim. Let's just fire. Let's fire a lot and we'll move forward. And give me a machine gun and I'll get things done. The high I says ready, fire, aim, right? Let's not take too long worrying about the details. Let's just go out there, have some fun and make it happen. The high S says, are you ready? Let's talk about how ready we're going to be. Are we ready? If we all get ready together, then we can start talking about aiming. And when we get comfortable with the readiness, we'll get comfortable with the aiming. Then we'll discuss the next step, which is firing. And of course, at this point, when the S is saying that, the D is like, give me the gun, I'll shoot. All right. High C's translation of it is ready, aim, 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 aim. They want more data, right? They love following rules, regulations, and structure. High C's, when they come in a new situation, always want to say, okay, what are the parameters? What are our processes? What are our policies? What are our procedures? Let's make sure we're within the parameters that are appropriate. And then whatever creativity we have, let's make sure that it's not outside the box so much that we create unintended consequences from our work. They love doing quality work. They love doing it right the first time, no matter how long it takes. They're not as good with deadlines because they want to get it right and they believe that time can be the enemy of quality. They tend to be careful and cautious. They're pretty neat. In fact, high C's walk into high I's offices and usually are stunned that someone could be to this level, that they're the same level as them in life and look like a complete jackass because their office is a total disaster. High I's are famous for using the floor to stack things, and high C's are like, no, there's a place for everything. They're always on time for meetings. Now, some of you may be saying, wait, I have a boss who's a high C and a high D, and he's not or she's not on time for meetings. Well, that's their high D portion, not their high C. They feel bad about being late, but the high D causes them to be late. They're totally knowledgeable about the details of a system or a project. Unfortunately, they are seen by others as perfectionists to a fault. They're seen as aloof because, remember, arm's length, going back, left-hand side, task-focused, arm's length. They're not seen as terribly creative because they just want to follow the rules. And if the rule was right, why would we need to change it? They ask questions in order to understand situations. They don't chat. They're not warm and fuzzy. They don't waste words. They want to get right to the work. They much prefer writing emails to having conversations. It's easier for them to be precise and to edit their words. They love bullets in emails, by the way. Just ask Mike. He loves them. They want an email to be structured, right? They want them to be structured. They tend to talk a little bit more quietly, a little bit more slowly than other people, certainly less than D's and I's. They have more pauses. They're carefully choosing their words. They want to say correct sentences. They tend to make smaller gestures than D's and I's do. They're like S's in that way. And they tend to move around less, and they tend to make less eye contact than D's and I's tend to do. And I'll say this now, I should have said it earlier. The ideal team is one where you've got a little bit of all this in the mix. If you've got a team of nothing but high D's folks, nothing's going to get done because everybody's going to kill each other in order to become the leader of a team. If the high I's get together, if you have nothing but high I's in your team, you're not going to get any work done because you're going to go to the bar at 10 in the morning and you're not going to leave. If you have nothing but high S's, you're not going to get anything done because nobody's going to want to make a decision without staffing with everybody. And the first decision is, when might we meet? Well, I wouldn't want to choose. You choose. No, you choose. Let's make sure we do this right and so on. And the high C's, if you have a team of high C's, no one's going to nothing's going to get done. And by the way, folks, I'm overstating this a little bit in order to make a point. A team of high C's won't get anything done because they'll be too busy agreeing on when the meeting's going to be and what the agenda will be. And so they'll never actually get to the meeting to make a decision. If you take all four of these and you put them together, you'll discover that the world of work is incredibly diverse, behaviorally diverse, and you are surrounded by behavior every day. And paying attention to other people's behavior is the best way to predict their future behavior. And most of us don't even see the behaviors. We literally see somebody do something and then we immediately label it. And we're suggesting, don't label it. Pay attention to the behaviors. Pay attention to a whole bunch of behaviors. Draw a conclusion about a tendency that person has and then predict forward. And that will help you change your behavior to work more effectively with them. And that's what this is about. DISC is about working more effectively with people who are different than you, which is the ultimate in diversity, in our opinion.
Awesome. Thanks, man.
My pleasure.
All righty. We'll see you.